Chapter 6. Devotions with an act of pity, pressed a sequin in the man's hand, and bid him spare no care for the sufferer's comfort. This sent Odo in a cheerful mood to the red-hung windows, whence, peering between the folds of his aunt's gala habits, he admired the great court enclosed in nobly ordered cloisters, and strewn with fresh herbs and flowers. Thence one of the rector's chaplains conducted them to the church, placing them, in company with the monastery's other noble guests, in a tribune constructed above the choir. It was Odo's first sight of a great religious ceremony, and as he looked down on the church glimmering with votive offerings and gold-fringed draperies, and seen through rolling incense in which the altar candles swam like stars reflected in a river, he felt an almost sensual thrill of pleasure at the thought that his life was to be passed amid scenes of such mystic beauty. The sweet singing of the choir raised his spirit to a higher view of the scene, and the sight of the huddled misery on the floor of the church revived in him the old longing for the Franciscan cowl. From these raptures he was speedily diverted by the sight awaiting him at the conclusion of the Mass. Hardly had the spectators returned to the rector's windows when, the doors of the church swinging open, a procession headed by the rector himself descended the steps, and began to make the circuit of the court. Odo's eyes swam with the splendor of this burst of banners, images and jeweled reliquaries, surmounting the long train of tonsured heads, and bathed in a light almost blinding after the mild penumbra of the church. As the monks advanced, the pilgrims, pouring after them, filled the court with a dark undulating mass through which the procession wound like a ray of sunlight down the brown bosom of a torrent. Branches of olander swung in the air, devout cries hailed the approach of the Black Madonna's canopy, and hoarse voices swelled to roar the measured litanies of the friars. The ceremonies over, Odo, with the canonesses, set out to visit the chapel studding the beech knoll above the monastic buildings. Passing out of Juvara's great portico they stood a moment above the grassy common, which presented a scene in curious contrast to that they had just quitted. Here refreshment booths had been set up, musicians were fiddling, jugglers unrolling their carpets, dentists shouting out the merits of their panaceas, and light women drinking with the liveried servants of the nobility. The very cripples who had groaned the loudest in church now rollicked with the mountebanks and dancers, and no trace remained of the celebration just concluded, but the medals and relics strung about the necks of those engaged in these gross diversions. It was strange to pass from this scene to the solitude of the grove, where, in a twilight rustling with streams, the chapels lifted their white porches. Peering through the grated door of each little edifice, Odo beheld within a group of terracotta figures representing some scene of the Passion here a Last Supper, with a tigerish Judas and a Saint John resting his yellow curls on his master's bosom, there an entombment or a group of stricken Marys. These figures, though rudely modeled and daubed with bright colors, yet, by a vivacity of attitude and gesture which the mystery of their setting enhanced, conveyed a thrilling impression of the sacred scene set forth. And Odo was yet at an age when the distinction between flesh and blood, and its plastic counterfeits is not clearly defined, or when at least the sculptured image is still a mysterious half-sentient thing, denizen of some strange borderland between art and life. It seemed to him, as he gazed through the chapel gratings, that those long-distant episodes of the divine tragedy had been here preserved in some miraculous state of suspended animation, and as he climbed from one shrine to another he had the sense of treading the actual stones of Gethsemane and Calvary. As was usual with him, the impressions of the moment had effaced those preceding it, and it was almost with surprise that, at the rector's door, he beheld the primo soprano of Pianura totter forth to the litter, and offer his knee as a step for the canonesses. The charitable ladies cried out on him for this imprudence, and his pallor still giving evidence of distress, he was bidden to wait on them after supper with his story. He presented himself promptly in the parlor, and being questioned as to his condition at once rashly proclaimed his former connection with the Dusel Theater of Pianura. No avowal could have been more disastrous to his cause. The canonesses crossed themselves with horror, and the abate, seeing his mistake, hastened to repair it by exclaiming, "Pat, ladies, would you punish me for following a vocation to which my frivolous parents condemned me, when I was too young to resist their purpose? And have not my subsequent sufferings, my penances and pilgrimages, and the state to which they have reduced me, sufficiently effaced the record of an involuntary error?" Seeing the effect of this appeal, the abate made haste to follow up his advantage. "Ah, illustrious ladies," he cried, "am I not a living example of the fate of those who leave all to follow righteousness? For while I remained on the stage, among the most dissolute surroundings, fortune showered me with every benefit she heaps on her favorites. I had my seat at every table in Pianura, the Duke's chair to carry me to the theater, and more money than I could devise how to spend. While now that I have resigned my calling to embrace the religious life, you see me reduced to begging a crust from the very mendicants I formerly nourished. For," said he, moved to tears by his own recital, "my superfluity was always spent in buying the prayers of the unfortunate, and to judge how I was esteemed by those acquainted with my private behavior, you need only learn that, on my renouncing the stage, 'twas the Bishop of Pianura who himself accorded me the tonsure." This discourse, which Odo admired for its adroitness, visibly excited the commiseration of the ladies. But at mention of the bishop, Don Olivia exchanged a glance with her sister, who inquired, with a quaint air of astuteness, "But how comes it, abate, that with so powerful a protector you have been exposed to such incredible reverses?" Canto presto roll de minimi. "Alas, madam, it was through my protector that misfortune attacked me. For his lordship having appointed me secretary to his favorite nephew, Don Serafino, that imprudent nobleman required of me services so incompatible with my cloth, that disobedience became a duty, whereupon, not satisfied with dismissing me in disgrace, he punished me by blackening my character to his uncle. To defend myself was to traduce Don Serafino, and rather than reveal his courses to the bishop, I sank to the state in which you see me, a state," he added with emotion, "that I have traveled this long way to commend to the adorable pity of her whose son had not where to lay his head." This stroke visibly touched the canonesses, still soft from the macerations of the morning, and Don Olivia compassionately asked how he had subsisted since his rupture with the bishop. "Madam, by the sale of my talents in any service, not at odds with my calling, as the compiling of pious almanacs, the inditing of rhymed litanies and canticles, and even the construction of theatrical pieces, the ladies lifted hands of reprobation, f theatrical pieces," canto presto impressively repeated, "for the use of the Carmelite nuns of Pianura. But," said he with a deprecating smile, "the wages of virtue are less liberal than those of sin, and spite of a versatility I think I may honestly claim, I have often had to subsist on the gifts of the pious, and sometimes, madam, to starve on their compassion." This ready discourse, and the soprano's evident distress, so worked on the canonesses that, having little money at their disposal, it was fixed, after some private consultation, that he should attend them to Donna's, where Don Gervaso, in consideration of his edifying conduct in renouncing the stage, might be interested in helping him to a situation. And when the little party set forth from Europa, the abate canto presto closed the procession on one of the baggage mules, with Odo riding pillion at his back. Good fortune loosened the poor soprano's tongue, and as soon as the canoness's litter was a safe distance ahead, he began to beguile the way with fragments of reminiscence and adventure. Though few of his allusions were clear to Odo, the glimpse they gave of the motley theatrical life of the North Italian cities, the quarrels between Goldeneye and the supporters of the expiring Commedia dell'arte, the rivalries of the prime Don, and the arrogance of the popular comedians, all these peeps into a tinsel world of mirth, cabal and folly, enlivened by the recurring names of the four masks, those lingering gods of the older dispensation. So lured the boy's fancy and set free his vagrant wonder, that he was almost sorry to see the keep of Donna's reddening in the second evening sunset. Such regrets, however, their arrival at the castle soon effaced, for in the doorway stood the old Marquess, a letter in hand, who springing forward caught his grandson by the shoulders, and cried with his great boar-hunting shout, "Cavalier, you are heir presumptive of Pianura." 1.7. The Marquess of Cerveno had succumbed to the tertian ague contracted at the hunting lodge of Pontesordo, and this unforeseen calamity left but one life, that of the sickly ducal infant, between Odo and the succession to the throne of Pianura. Such was the news conveyed post-haste from Turin by Donna Laura, who added the Duke's express wish that his young kinsman should be fitted for the secular career, and the information that Count Valdu had already entered his stepson's name at the Royal Academy of Turin. The Duke of Pianura being young, and in good health, and his wife having already given him an heir, the most sanguine imagination could hardly view Odo as being brought much nearer the succession. Yet the change in his condition was striking enough to excuse the fancy of those about him for shaping the future to their liking. The priestling was to turn courtier and perhaps soldier, Asti was to be exchanged for Turin, the seminary for the academy, and even the old chief of Donna's betrayed in his grumbling counsels to the boy a sense of the exalted future in which they might someday serve him. The preparations of departure and the wonder of his new state left Odo little space wherein to store his thought with impressions of what he was leaving, and it was only in after years, when the accretion of superficial incident had dropped from his past, that those last days at Donna's gained their full distinctness. He saw them then, heavy with the warmth of the long summer, from the topmost pine belt to the bronzed vineyards turning their metallic clusters to the sun. And in the midst his small bewildered figure, netted in a web of association, and seeming, as he broke away, to leave a shred of himself in every corner of the castle. Sharpest of all, there remained with him the vision of his last hour with Don Gervaso. The news of Odo's changed condition had been received in silence by the chaplain. He was not the man to waste words, and he knew the futility of asserting the church's claim to the heir presumptive of a reigning house. Therefore, if he showed no enthusiasm, he betrayed no resentment. But, the evening before the boy's departure, led him, still in silence, to the chapel. Here the priest knelt with Odo, then, raising him, sat on one of the benches facing the high altar, and spoke a few grave words. "You are setting out," said he, "on a way far different from that in which it has been my care to guide you. Yet the high road and the mountain path may, by diverse windings, lead to the same point, and whatever walk a man chooses, it will surely carry him to the end that God has appointed. If you are called to serve him in the world, the journey on which you are now starting may lead you to the throne of Pianura. But even so," he went on, "there is this I would have you remember, that should this dignity come to you, it may come as a calamity, rather than a joy, for when God confers earthly honors on a child of his predilection, he sometimes deigns to render them as innocuous as misfortune, and my chief prayer for you is that you should be raised to this eminence, it may be at a moment when such advancement seems to thrust you in the dust." The words burned themselves into Odo's heart like some mystic writing on the walls of memory, long afterward to start into fiery meaning. At the time he felt only that the priest spoke with a power and dignity no human authority could give, and for a moment all the stored influences of his faith reached out to him from the dimly gleaming altar. The next sun rose on a new world. He was to set out at daylight, and dawn found him at the casement, footing it in thought down the road as yet undistinguishable in a dying glimmer of stars. Bruno was to attend him to Turin, but one of the women presently brought word that the old huntsman's rheumatism had caught him in the knee, and that the Marquess, resolved not to delay his grandson's departure, had chosen Cantapresto as the boy's companion. The courtyard, when Odo descended, fairly bubbled with the voluble joy of the fat soprano, who was giving directions to the servants, receiving commissions and instructions from the aunts, assuring everybody of his undying devotion to the heir presumptive of Pianura, and citing impressive instances of the responsibilities with which the great of the earth had formerly entrusted him. As a companion for Odo, the abate was clearly not to Don Gervaso's taste, but he stood silent, turning the comment of a cool eye on the soprano's protestations, and saying only, as Cantapresto swept the company into the circle of an obsequious farewell, "Emimer, signor abate, it is to your cloth this business is entrusted." The abate's answer was a rush of purple to the forehead. But Don Gervaso imperturbably added, "A new lie, but one night on the road." Meanwhile, the old Marquess, visibly moved, was charging Odo to respect his elders and superiors, while in the same breath warning him not to take up with the Frenchified notions of the court, but to remember that for a lad of his condition the chief virtues were a tight seat in the saddle, a quick hand on the sword, and a slow tongue in council. "Mind your own business," he concluded, "and see that others mind theirs." The Marchioness thereupon, with many tears, hung a scapular about Odo's neck, bidding him shun the theater, and be regular at confession. One of the canonesses reminded him not to omit a visit to the chapel of the Holy Winding Sheet, while the other begged him to burn a candle for her at the Consolata, and the servants pressed forward to embrace and bless their little master. Day was high by this, and as the Marquess's traveling chariot rumbled down the valley the shadow seemed to fly before it. Odo at first lay numb, but presently his senses woke to the call of the brightening landscape. The scene was such as Salvator might have painted. Wild blocks of stone heaped under walnut shade, here the white plunge of water down a wall of granite, and there, in bluer depths, a charcoal burner's hut sending up its spiral of smoke to the dark raftering of branches. Though it was but a few hours since Odo had traveled from Europa, years seemed to have passed over him, and he saw the world with a new eye. Each sound and scent plucked at him in passing. The roadside started into detail like the foreground of some minute Dutch painter. Every pendant mass of fern, dark dripping rock, late tuft of harebell called out to him, "Colon, look well, for this is your last sight of us." His first sight too, it seemed. Since he had lived through 12 Italian summers without sense of the sun-steeped quality of atmosphere that, even in shade, gives each object a golden salience. He was conscious of it now only as it suggested fingering a missal stiff with gold leaf, and etched with a swarming diversity of bugs and insects. The carriage moved so slowly that he was in no haste to turn the pages, and each spike of yellow foxglove, each clouding of butterflies about a patch of speedwell, each quiver of grass over a hidden thread of moisture, became a marvel to be thumbed and treasured. From this mood he was detached by the next bend of the road. The way, hitherto winding through narrow glens, now swung to a ledge overhanging the last escarpment of the mountains, and far below, the Piedmontese plain unrolled to the southward its interminable blue-green distances mottled with forest. A sight to lift the heart, for on those sunny reaches Ivrea, Novara, Versailles lay like seabirds on a summer sea. It was the future unfolding itself to the boy. Dark forests, wide rivers, strange cities and a new horizon. All the mystery of the coming years figured to him in that great plain stretching away to the greater mystery of heaven. To all this Cantapresto turned a snoring countenance. The lively air of the hills, the good fare of Donnas, and the satisfaction, above all, of rolling on cushions over a road he had thought to trudge on foot, had lapped the abate in Capulan slumber. The midday halt aroused him. The travelers rested at an inn on the edge of the hills, and here Cantapresto proved to his charge that, as he phrased it, his belly had as short a memory for food as his heart for injuries. A flask of Asti put him in the talking mood, and as they drove on he regaled Odo with a lively picture of the life on which he was about to enter. "You are going," said he, "to one of the first cities of Europe. one that has all the beauty and elegance of the French capital without its follies and excesses. Turin is blessed with a court, where good manners and a fine tone are more highly prized than the extravagances of genius, and I have heard it said of His Majesty that he was delighted to see his Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.